Good morning and happy autumn. My name is Michael McCusker. I awoke out of sleep a few nights ago and heard through an open bedroom window the squawks of birds passing overhead in the darkness, flying south in large flocks for what seemed a long time. As of yesterday, September 23rd, the receding sun has crossed beyond the equatorial line. The summer just ended will most likely be recorded as the hottest ever, as have several previous summers, predictably to lose the record after next summer. Perhaps we might think of climate change from a bird's eye view. The steady eradication of the world's tropical rainforests threatens to rid the northern hemisphere of most birds. Each spring, fewer birds return from the south. Almost 200 species of North America alone are threatened with extinction. The rainforests are hosts to half of all bird life. Between 20 to 30 million birds fly south every autumn, which is the most extensive and oldest migration of creatures on Earth. So at the beginning of what might also be a record-shattering fall up here halfway between equator and North Pole, I wish to mark the change of seasons with an article I wrote for the August 1988 issue of a newspaper I published once upon a time long ago, the North Coast Times Eagle. I should at this point give a disclaimer that the following is my opinion and mine only in all the cosmos, galaxies, and worldly hemispheres that are changing seasons, wherever they may be, in however many multiple universes. I would like to start with a short poem written by my friend Jamie Linton when she was age 8. Now she has a daughter, age 8. It's called The Sun. The sun shines like a bright light. The sun shines so bright you won't miss a sight. So watch out for the sun. Life in the greenhouse. The funniest thing about choking on our affluence is that we think we are so smart. We think we have overpowered nature after centuries of pitiless struggle and are able now to crack the earth with our power. We don't want to give up the good life, the modern life of appliances and holographic reality. We ignore or trivialize warnings that we are fouling our nest, behaving with a false hubris of entitlement that regards humanity as Earth's only patron. Our long feast on Earth's flesh is giving us gas. Mother is biting back. It is probably true that whatever pain the human race causes its home planet, Earth will recover. Homo sapiens will depart in a stink. Our proximity to extinction is not from any single cause or danger or combination of them, but because we seem so helpless to undo the damage or change direction. The byproducts of our ways of life are of less concern than our unwillingness to reverse their harm. Our doom will be the result of our lack of intelligent courage to face up to consequences. The terms are quite simple. If we have the moxie, we might survive. If not, we won't. Earth will abide, whichever way we choose. We have built ourselves a global greenhouse and we dwell within. Greenhouse gases are emitted by human activity and magnify heat radiated back to Earth from an invisible ceiling structured by chemicals released by excessive use of fossil fuels, pesticides, and fluorocarbons that also eat away the upper-level ozone. Beloved Sol heats up our planet at the same time depletion of the ozone screen makes sunlight dangerous. The weather heats up. Summers in particular are increasingly hot and dry. Each summer is the hottest recorded. Desertification is more rampant. Droughts are longer and more frequent, resulting in recurrent famine and intense wildfires. We have pummeled and plundered our home planet as if it offered an inexhaustible feast without charge or cleanup. But the consequences of our careless and excessive self-indulgence are converging. So what can we do about our self-inflicted danger? What will we do about it? Our problems seem so vast and complex, the solutions are nearly impossible to agree upon. Yet postponing answers and action leads almost always to denial and rejection of the problems, and thus their solutions. The consequences of our ways of life are of less concern than our unwillingness to reverse their harm. We have to stop abusing Earth, but we find infinite rationales for continuing to mutilate it. Draconian measures to reduce air pollution can only buy time and perhaps place a partial ceiling on the ultimate warming. It is already necessary to plan how to cope with the consequences of a hotter world, such as rising seas and abruptly varying weather patterns. We know how to break the pains of our great greenhouse jail, stop clear-cutting Earth's remaining forests and replant logged-over areas, reduce eventually to zero our reliance on fossil fuel burning in favor of non-polluting energy sources, stop using toxic defoliants that have, in hardly more than half a century, been absorbed into everything. Strong measures to slow toxic emissions and decrease the inevitable temperature rise are crucial. More than anything else, the most immediate and necessary measure is a change of attitude. We simply have to stop abusing our scarred and sun-blistered Earth. And as I said, that was something I wrote, and it's sort of revised from the North Coast Times Eagle issue, August 1988. My friend, Dr. Charles Wilder, died last Thursday, September 17th. All his friends knew him as Chuck, or Charlie, but many were probably unaware of his doctorate in social welfare, which he received from the turbulent Berkeley campus of the University of California. Chuck was a community organizer and the first director of Clatsop County Community Action, which continues 3 decades later as it was primarily intended to be an anti-poverty agency. He was also a professional musician. He played jazz piano in Astoria for a long time in many night spots, either solo or accompanied by musicians and singers, notably his famous longtime duo with the late great drummer Michael Rush. He was a founding member of the North Coast Jazz Quartet. Jim Wilkins said about Chuck's balancing act between the poverty agency and playing piano in local clubs and pubs. Chuck's work there, Clatsop Community Action, pays him a meager wage, which, combined with the meager wage he makes with the piano, allows him to exist. I am surprised the local mainstream media has not taken notice of Chuck's death, or should I say, Dr. Charles, and profiled his laudable life. Yet, of course, he was not a prominent business person, nor a banker, lawyer, or politician, or, for that matter, a mainstream media mogul. He just played jazz and helped poor people, which more and more of us are becoming, not least because of the above prominent obituary prospects who were slavered over in their death notices. Chuck wrote an article for my now-defunct newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, back in 1987, the March issue, which could very well serve as an autobiographical vignette that aptly reflected his bicameral, or biaxial, life. He wrote this mini-memoir on Martin Luther King's birthday that year, 1987, and dedicated it to his daughters, Adelaide, Cara, and Emily. And I dedicate my reading of it on today's program to Chuck and to his wife, Jill, and to his 3 daughters. He called it, "My Heroes Have Never Been Cowboys," by Chuck Wilder. And a quote by Dr. Charles Wilder, "The war on poverty has become the war on the poor." I grew up with mostly white ethnic steelworkers and gangsters in Youngstown, Ohio, where the rivers caught fire and the snow turned gray overnight. The satanic mills are idle now, Cuyahoga Rivers, but a lingering death for the steelworkers. As a kid, I was what they euphemistically called a bad egg. So my family, members of the minority WASP small business clique, often sent me to my room at night. There I would lie in the dark, fiddling with the dial of my silver-tone radio, tracing the contours of the universe like the blind man in the cave. Alan Freed was in Cleveland, then calling himself Moondog. At exactly midnight, this unspeakably funky, erotic baritone sax would launch into his theme, Blues for the Red Boy, by the Todd Rhodes Band. The later it got, the more stations you could pick up. Detroit, Chicago, New York, and from Boston, the legendary Symphony Sid. That's when I started listening to Bird and Art Tatum and Hampton Hawes and all those other shadowy, angelic figures who were going to rearrange my life. I was only 13 or 14, but through some genetic fluke, I could hear it right away. I went down to the record store and asked, "Do you have anything by Charlie Parker?" And they brought me this 10-inch LP with his picture on the cover. I took it in my pink little hands and stared at it and thought, this can't be him. This guy's black. I mean, I really did think the N-word, because that's how it was in that grimy little corner of industrial civilization gone berserk. Blacks were okay in their place, far away from our wives and daughters, company boardrooms, labor unions, crime syndicates, etc. They even excelled at certain primitive glandular stuff, like what you heard on some of the Nashville stations back then, or what they had in mind for our wives and daughters. But they weren't supposed to be able to cope very well with the intellectual and moral demands of high civilization, which is why they needed watching rather carefully. They weren't supposed to be able to forge from the crucible of their collective misery our most aesthetically advanced and technically challenging indigenous art form. Something was awry. My parents, neighbors, teachers, etc., were regular Christian folks. They wouldn't lie on purpose. But music has no purpose other than to be heard, and therefore can't lie at all. Anyhow, I wanted to learn it real bad, and the only way to do that was to go where it was being played. So it wasn't long before I was sneaking out of my room down to the local black and tan pubs and roadhouses and after-hours joints. Then on to Cleveland. When I was 15, my dad took me to hear Sonny Stitt at a place called the Hi-Hat, and later to Chicago and San Francisco, where history was being made every night at the Beehive and Jimbo's Bop City and other teeming, exotic, subterranean conservatories of that era. At certain times, they'd let me sit in, and that's how I started learning to play. But I learned something else, too. I learned real fast and hard and close up what our lives had done and were doing to a whole beautiful race of men, women, and children. Those buttons the Saul Alinsky organizers used to pass around the ghetto summed it up plenty. Is there life after birth? I got to thinking stuff like, how many Charlie Parkers and Billie Holidays have we effectively maimed, crippled, aborted, destroyed, before they ever got a chance to fly? And what of all the rest, the ones who couldn't run faster or fly higher than Whitey? Don't forget what they had given me. So I didn't have to wait for Vietnam to experience the kind of radical moral damage, not to be confused with anything so trifling or expungible as guilt, that would push me to the margins of society for the rest of my life. I gave up music for a long time and started reading and listening to Dr. King and getting involved in civil rights activities in the Bay Area. I hung out with beat poets, anarchists, trots, neo-wobblies, Muslims, SDSers, and even some of those real, chilly, straight-looking party guys, the commies, who would march right into a neighborhood and say, "Are you ready for the citywide rent strike, folks?" I started making the connections between race and poverty, power and privilege, and so on, taking it out into the streets. heady stuff, and for a while it worked. And partly because it worked, soon enough along comes John Kennedy and LBJ with their war on poverty, their war on poverty hype, saying, hey, kid, don't get too weird, because we'll send you to graduate school and train you and pay you to fight in a way that'll make your mom and dad and your president proud, and you'll have a real income so you can play music on the weekends. Everybody likes to fit in somewhere, get a little status and legitimacy. I was such a pushover that I'm still doing it all these years later, when Ronnie Reagan at the helm, busting his cruel little britches to rid the land of all us damaged, marginal types. America had found a place for us after all, just like Herbert Marcuse said it would be in One-Dimensional Man. We would be sequestered in universities and bureaucracies with responsible-sounding names like Human Resources Development Council, Incorporated. We could dissect the beast, contrive piecemeal solutions, and do society's dirty work. They even invented an Alice in Wonderland phrase to describe it, working within the system, just to remind us that there was only one system and who was in control. I wonder how much longer I can do it. It's getting awfully cold out there again, and we're losing so much ground. Mostly, I just want to climb into my bubble and play. Nothing can touch you there, and sometimes you can bring folks a little ways home, back to music as a symbolic form, an evolving of the human spirit, and not just a vortex of sensations. Sometimes I even imagine that if I play my piano good enough, if I squeeze the music out of the deepest chambers of my soul like the heart pumps blood, maybe it'll help bring a few people closer together for a moment or two. That's what it's all about anyway, what Dr. King really tried to teach us. Which poet said it best? Rex Roth, Auden, Rene Char? We must love one another or die. And at least for that brief, turbulent, historical moment of the 1960s, lots of us seemed to believe it, to believe that it was possible for each of us to identify with the suffering and thwarted hopes and aspirations of other human beings, wherever they were and whether or not we ever got to know their names or faces. And from that would come solidarity and commitment, sister and brotherhood, vision and steady work, the things Dr. King's birthday will forever stand for, and that America has already forgotten. In fact, some people still don't understand why we should have a national holiday for Dr. King. There are too many other deserving candidates, they say, chiefly white males. But I remember in the early 60s when I first started organizing in places like the Mission District and Hunter's Point, where you had families of seven living in two-room high-rise apartments and tenements with rats and roaches, rotten pipes and cracked plaster, enforced dependency, degradation, despair, and two out of three times there would be a picture on a wall, usually one of those cheap mass-produced red, white, and blue tapestries, a picture of Martin Luther King. And I'm here to tell you that's it. That's all the hope there was in that home, and millions like it all across America. Today we focus our national shame myopically on those who have no home at all. We invent a new sociological category, the homeless, a new code word for wholesale, systematically induced, and thoroughly preventable human misery and despair. The Reagan administration dawdles and broods over the onerous prospect of spending a couple of $100 million on the problem, not really the problem at all, only its most conspicuous casualties. After that is just finished, the administration has just finished decimating conventional public housing and other critically needed mainstream social programs in this country, after it has annually approved five times as much money for military bands as it has to house the homeless, and we let them get away with it. It's supposed to be our land, too, and that's another thing Dr. King tried to teach us, but it isn't anymore. I think we should try and take it back. I think we should quit screwing around, get off this networking kick, a another code word for some sort of quasi-political masturbation, and get down to some serious, sustained organizing, coalition building, social and political action. If this strikes some of you as rather old-fashioned and utopian, you're right. Old-fashioned because it's the only means short of violence by which a powerless people has ever managed to shape history rather than let it grind them into human fodder. Utopian because you've got to have a pretty big, powerful dream just to lever the real thing forward a few inches at a time. And one way or another, you've got to start at home. Look around the North Coast at all these little enclaves and coteries of artists, craftspeople, intellectuals, anti-nuclear groups, women's and human rights activists, hip entrepreneurs, and chic professionals, KMUNEs, Times Eagle muckrakers, and so on. But nothing much ever seems to happen. Just more coffee and conversation, more frazzled indignation, more networking. Some groups will take issue, saying, our impact is subtle, diffuse, prefigurative. You just can't measure it that way. Right. I'll be damned if I can get it to register at all. Which, I hasten to add, is not to dismiss either the intrinsic value or latent potential. Without these groups, we wouldn't even have that. Why, for instance, are we content to hand total initiative for community and economic development over to the Chamber of Commerce, the Port Authority, the military, the absentee corporations? Why do we only react at best? Why not get our own dreams and our own act together? If we don't, you can bet your quiche who's going to lose out, and then you may have to go someplace else to get away from the beast and talk about what needs to be done without bothering to do it. Of course, we're not unique. It's the same all over America these days. Why try to keep it secret? We're through trying. We've washed our hands of it. We just want to be left alone with our toys, our career paths, our self-fulfilling little projects and diversions, our omnivorous pursuit of meaningful relationships and rosy self-images. And that would be just fine. Who am I to knock it? Except for two things. First, we have no right to allow other people, very large numbers of people indeed, to suffer as a result of the same institutional arrangements that make it possible for us to carry on this way. Obviously, I am convinced not only that we have no such right, but also a positive obligation to change these arrangements. But I can't prove it to you. Either you understand it or you don't. Second, there is growing, many say conclusive, evidence that the planet itself cannot endure arrangements of this kind much longer. It needs us to come back to each other, just like the poet said. It needs us now. To these ears, it cries to us almost the way Billie Holiday did when she sang Strange Fruit. Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. And that was Billie Holiday. Once upon a time, Martin Luther King was my hero because I thought he stood for the kind of person we should all try to become in order to make a better world. It's no fairy tale any longer, but maybe I was wrong. Maybe he stood for what we must become to keep the one we've got. And that was by Chuck Wilder. My heroes have never been cowboys. And while I was going through a mass of pulp to find Chuck's story, my heroes were not cowboys, I found a whimsically sardonic piece he wrote for the Times Eagle a year later in the October 1988 issue. He was, at the time, director of Clatsop Community Action. And this by Chuck Wilder. Notice to the tenants of Emerald Heights. Since the government has never given official notice to the residents of Emerald Heights, I thought I would be a good citizen and volunteer to do it for them. and he signs it with a GSA form EH86, OBM approval 061Z, blah, blah, blah. Look, folks, Emerald Heights was never intended as a public housing project, and we certainly didn't mean to turn it into Clatsop County's largest single housing resource for low-income families. We just happened to own the place, and were nice enough to let you move in for a while. Then President Reagan told us to start selling off all the public domain we could as fast as we could. You know, everything from ball bearings to wilderness areas. To make matters worse, some of your private landlords started complaining about unfair competition. I mean, what the hell were we supposed to do? Now, if this was a real government housing program, we'd need congressional authorization to shut it down, and we'd have to take some responsibility for what's going to become of you and the local community. But it isn't. As I've already explained, it's not our results, but our intentions that count. So we don't owe you a thing. We don't have to do an impact study such as we routinely require of private industry whenever it looks like they might cause hardship or distress for the community. We don't care who buys the place or what they do with it as long as we get our price. And by God, we're digging our heels in on this one. We don't even have to notify you or your landlord as to when your home will be put up for sale, though feel free to call us anytime. Be thankful that your rights are fully protected under Oregon state law and that you can't be forcibly removed from your homes until 30 days after they're sold. As you pack your things, take comfort in the fact that by giving up your home, you will not only be helping us reduce the big D, but in your own small way, contributing to the revitalization of our free enterprise system. Which reminds me, if things really get tough, there's a nice little emergency shelter out on Clatsop Plains that can hold up to four families at a time. If you have further questions, please contact our GS-15 in San Francisco and hope that she or he is not away from his or her desk. Quote, we don't care. We don't have to. We're your federal government. Unquote. And that was by Chuck Wilder, and he said in his story that the last paragraph is used with apologies to Lily Tomlin. We'll go out with Chuck Wilder on piano on a piece called Why, played by the North Coast Jazz Quartet with Dave Drury, Jim Yitzhak, Michael Rush, and of course, Chuck Wilder. This has been Michael McCusker.
Why do you worry so much, baby? Tell me why do you hang your head so low, honey? Listen, idle gossip come from the devil's workshop. Sitting around worrying, honey, ain't gonna make you stop. So why do you let talk worry you, baby? Tell me why do you let them bug you like that, honey? Listen, I think somebody else has set their mind to get me. She's trying to find a way to drive you to quit me. I've been with you since the day we met. Nobody stays when they just don't care. And I ain't thinking about her going nowhere. So why do you let talk worry you, baby? Tell me why don't you tell her what you should know by now, honey? And that is, you should know by now the love bug has hit me. No other girl.